DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Helen Sini in Germany. On today's programme, riots, race and a reckoning. Days of violence rock the UK.
It's a scene that makes you hold your breath. Dread what's next. Get them out. And then the moment those inside feared the most.
Also on Inside Europe, Ukraine's will to win at the Olympics. And the dangers posed by Russia's ghost fleet. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. It's been a dark week for the United Kingdom. Racist and anti-immigration riots spread across the country, quelled only on Wednesday night by thousands of peaceful counter-protesters. In the worst cases, rioters have attacked police with bricks, smashed in people's homes, and assaulted members of the public. The police say age-old phobias are being inflamed by social media, with extreme right-wing influencers spreading hatred online, even organising spontaneous riots. Hundreds of people have been arrested, and the government has deployed a standing army of officers to British communities. But though the violence has been criticised, many have sympathy with the rioters' concerns over immigration. From the Brexit politician Nigel Farage to the multi-billionaire social media owner Elon Musk, thousands have taken to social media to post anti-immigration comments. Our reporter Dan Ashby was on the scene in the aftermath of one of the worst riots, where a hotel housing immigrants was set on fire. He sent this report on the week in which Britain faced a reckoning over race and racism.
They are angry, they are armed, and in the worst of ironies, draped in British flags. It's a scene that makes you hold your breath, dread what's next. Because in Rotherham, in the north of England, it's obvious many of the 700 men and women are about to do something terrible. They have come to this hotel on purpose. It's known to house asylum seekers. And from the rooms above, people stare through windows, trapped, as the anger swells below. Police try tackling men to the ground, but the rioters are emboldened. They throw bricks and wooden stakes. Their shouts become louder. Get them out. And then the moment those inside feared the most. The sound of glass shattering, rioters overcoming police, hundreds of men, some armed, storm inside, nobody left to stop them. Flames erupt. A bonfire in a large bin is rolled against the hotel. It is a moment to make Britain choke in shame. The idea, the risk, that refugee families might be about to be burned alive. Thank goodness they did not. In the end, the police broke the rioters, but the morning after, it all seems even more senseless.
Right now, men in orange suits are carrying out furniture and throwing them away, I guess because they're damaged, destroyed or covered in glass, the debris and shattered windows all over the floor. There must be at least 30 to 40 police officers around the area and a huge window smashed in, looking into a room. It must have been quite terrifying.
The refugees have been moved on, but many of the families living nearby were also swept up in it.
As I turned round, about 200 come from our house and had to walk through them all. It was a bit frightening, but...
Yeah, and I guess I didn't realise it was so close. Your kids would have been seeing that and seeing the fires. Yeah. And
we tried to keep it. I mean, little one's only five, but it broke my heart because last night... Her mum allows her to just text her auntie and she'd text her auntie and just put, "I love you, I'm so scared."
Oh, and she's nine.
And she, and it broke my heart to see that message, you know?
Oh my goodness, that she was that scared that she's writing, that's horrible.
Yeah.
But this community epitomises a wound in Britain that is beginning to fester. They may deplore the violence that came here, but they don't welcome the refugees either.
It's not fair to people. You get a woman goes around the lake on her own, you get followed. They're whistling at little kids. I've got an 8-year-old granddaughter that wanted to come yesterday and said, "Can I write on a sign, please go home, we want to feel safe." That's an 8-year-old child.
Really? She wanted to write that and come
she
here?
She wanted to come and she wanted to write that on a sign. And it's every time you don't feel safe.
That lingering fear and frustration with immigrants, sometimes legitimate, other times racist, is present in communities across the UK. And the extreme right has taken this moment to put a tinder keg into it. The riots began after three girls were murdered and extremists falsely claimed an immigrant was behind the attack. That incident was the spark, but not the cause. Far-right extremists were waiting for a moment, organised by influencers with millions of followers who spread racist lies, and now flag up mosques, hotels, even law firms worthy of attack. But do the riots underscore growing frustration that even the police can't quell? There's one voice, never far from the headlines, making that case.
What Starmer doesn't understand, and when he says, "I'm going to stop the far right," what he doesn't understand is the general feeling of dissatisfaction that has been out there in this country growing for years.
Brexiteer Nigel Farage's anti-immigration party won 14% of the vote in last month's election, and he says only a ban of mass migration will stop the cause of the riots.
I talked in the general election about societal breakdown. What I meant by that were communities being split apart, people not even recognising the centres of some of our towns and cities as even being vaguely English anymore.
But many millions disagree with Farage and blame Britain's long history of racism as the root cause.
This riot is, at its essence, a consequence of the failure of the British establishment in confronting the monsters of history.
Udit Thackeray lived as an immigrant near Rotherham for 6 years. He was verbally and physically abused about his race multiple times.
I'm triggered because it brings back horrible memories of the abuse I have experienced.
Like thousands of others posting online, the riots make him feel scared to live or visit the UK.
I was scared. I was just scared, and I continue to be scared.
He believes racism is rampant in British life, enabled by the ruling classes, and the riots are an extreme expression of it.
The average white Briton simply does not understand how race it is entirely constructed.
As this report was filed, the riots continued, and so did the soul-searching for answers. But when it comes to the violence, the attempted burning of families, the stamping on people's heads, the fear, Udit has a warning. Perhaps there's no rationality to be found.
The quest to look for human logic in this is like beating your head on a wall. There is no logic to it.
That report from Dan Ashby. And as Dan mentioned, the riots were seemingly triggered by the shocking murder of three small girls in the city of Southport in the northwest of England. But as our reporter Lush Bavanga writes in this postcard from nearby Manchester, nothing happens in a vacuum.
It's been nearly 2 weeks since a 17-year-old boy entered a children's dance class, killed three little girls and severely injured many more. We still know nothing of his motive and little about his background, other than that he was born in the UK to Rwandan parents. At the end of that shocking day, I, like so many others, wanted to understand what had happened. X, formerly known as Twitter, was already full of conspiracy theories and a growing hatred directed at groups who for many have become the go-to scapegoats, immigrants and particularly Muslims. a Muslim-sounding name was being widely shared. Like most of the wild theories bandied about, it was false. Yet the next day, just hours after the grief-stricken Southport community had held a dignified vigil, a violent mob descended to attack the local mosque and then the police, trying to quell the riot, many of whom had run into danger to try to stop the knife attacker just the day before. The riots have since spread across English cities and to Belfast in Northern Ireland. In perhaps the most shocking incident so far, a mob tried to block the exit and set fire to a hotel housing asylum seekers. When I moved to this country nearly 30 years ago, it appeared to me a successful multicultural society, far more advanced than my native Norway, which in the 1990s was still extremely homogeneously white. This week, people I know here have been scared to walk to work because they have darker skin. And yet I am not entirely surprised. These riots, shocking as they are not happening in a vacuum. As humans, we seem hardwired to fear the unknown and quick to blame the others for everything that goes wrong. Vote-hungry politicians across Europe have turned immigration into a central policy plank. Successive UK governments have talked about creating a hostile environment for so-called illegal immigrants and have used terms like a flood or an invasion. The outgoing Conservative government made stopping asylum seekers from arriving on boats across the Channel one of their top priorities during this year's election. Such language is endlessly amplified in a largely unregulated social media environment because it generates income for the owners. Why else would Elon Musk, owner of X, with 193 million followers, himself be peddling conspiracy theories and literally egging the violent rioters on here in the UK? To be clear, this country, like most other European countries, depends on immigrant labour, not least in the healthcare sector, to look after an ageing population. The fresh Labour Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, a former director of public prosecutions, has promised swift justice for those found guilty of violent disorder. Arrests and sentencing have already begun. This will probably quell the violence for now, but the underlying hatred of the others, fueled by political rhetoric and click-hungry tech billionaires, will not go away. Maybe we should all do as the locals in Southport did on the day after the riots there. Go out, tidy up, help repair the mosque, make tea and talk to each other. Lars Bevanger, DW, Manchester.
Still to come on the programme, Ukraine's will to win at the Olympics and the dangers posed by Russia's ghost fleet. I'm Helen Sini in Germany and you're listening to Inside Europe. Ukraine has sent its smallest summer Olympics team ever to the Paris Games, just 140 members. The war against Russia has killed hundreds of the country's most promising athletes and made it difficult for surviving ones to train and compete. Still, Ukraine has scooped up a number of Olympic medals in the French capital. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
One of the walls of Ukraine's Olympic Pavilion here in northeastern Paris carries a gigantic sign, the will to win. It's impossible not to think about the bigger battle.
It's very important to show over the world Ukrainian resilience, the Ukrainian will to win.
That's Ukraine's acting sports minister, Matvey Bidney, a former champion bodybuilder.
They have a non-precedent Ukraine now to be in a full-scale war with a huge aggressor with a huge army and take part in a big sports event in a big team under our flag. And what's very important is that Russian flag isn't here.
Russia was barred from competing in the Paris Games. Just over a dozen Russians are competing as individual neutral athletes. Ukraine is paying a bigger price. Minister Bidney says more than 3,000 athletes and trainers have taken up weapons since the war broke out in 2022. Nearly 500 have died. This Olympic pavilion, known as Ukraine House, is filled with reminders of the conflict, like this band performing, backdropped by images of the war. Or a poster of a partially destroyed stadium in the northeastern city of Kharkiv.
A lot of sports facilities damaged, more than 520 sports facilities damaged or destroyed, totally destroyed. In winter, when the Russian rockets hit our energetics, the temperature of the sports environment was something like a 0 degree in Celsius.
Judo athlete Bohdan Yadov's father serves in Ukraine's army.
My father defend our country. I really want to see my father because 2 years I didn't see my father. So it's really hard to live in war. I'm always pray for this war end soon.
Yadov lost his Olympic match. He's now rooting for the rest of Team Ukraine.
I'm really proud in this time represented my country, and I'm really proud to be Ukrainian.
Badminton player Polina Borova lives and trains in Italy, but her homeland isn't far from her mind. She sang this song for the audience at Ukraine House.
It's always very hard mentally to prepare, to understand, to accept, and to go and fight, because especially when you go on court, you want to show the best for Ukraine. You want to make country proud. You want to make people proud.
Politicians, but also fans from all over, are visiting the pavilion. Jesper Lindholt lives in Kyiv. His Danish-Ukrainian family lives outside the country.
So I'm very happy to be in this place and see how they also carry the message, the two-sided message that it's important to be here. Although people are fighting, it's important to be part of the world community. While still fighting on behalf of world community, Ukraine is fighting.
Ukraine's team will be heading home after the Paris Games wrap up Sunday, back to a war that doesn't seem likely to end anytime soon. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
After Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, the European Union and the G7 sought to reduce Moscow's war budget by sanctioning its oil exports. It's now illegal for Russia to sell oil for more than $60 per barrel and for companies to provide insurance to transport oil selling for more than that price. To get around these restrictions, the Kremlin is using deceptive means that could be dangerous for countries bordering the Baltic Sea. Terry Schulz reports.
Floating disasters just waiting to happen. That's how Greenpeace's Suna Scheller describes the decrepit vessels Russia is increasingly using to get around sanctions on its oil exports imposed over its war in Ukraine. These ships are often called a dark fleet, a shadow fleet, or a ghost fleet, because they're hiding the fact that they often aren't seaworthy, carry flags and insurance from countries which don't observe international sanctions, and are often operated by inexperienced crews who don't know the area. Here's Suna Scheller.
These oil tankers normally have a lifespan on maybe 10, 15 years, and then they're worn out, and then they're sent for scraps. But the whole shadow fleet is basically made up of these oil ships that were meant to be scrapped, but has now been bought up and is still sailing right. Some of them are 15 years, some of them are 20, some of them are more than 25 years old. And that is not a proper age for an oil tanker carrying 100,000 tons of oil. So it's extremely much more risky.
The Danish Straits are so narrow in some places that you can see Sweden on the other side. They're international waters, so Russia has the right to sail here. But there's already been a collision with empty tankers, Scheller says, and next time might not be so lucky.
And it's just a matter of time when it's going to happen again. It is very obvious because it's just out there. It's just passing by our waters on a daily basis with this increased extreme risk associated to it. And you just hope every day you go in, and I check my tracking and what else I do. following this subject that it's not the news about an accident that hits you. And no one has the capacity to clean this up. The Danish Navy doesn't have it. No one would expect the Russian government to come and clean it up. The responsible company can often not be found. Maybe the insurance is fraudulent and they will not come and clean it up, right? So we're left with the bill. We're left with the cleanup.
Some experts say the shadow fleet now carries 4/5 of all Russia's exports of crude oil under the regulatory radar. Jacob Kjuks-Bohr, a reporter with the investigative journalism outlet Danwatch in Copenhagen, has been exposing the fleet's murky business practices.
Lots of them, they've been bought recently by companies in India or Dubai or places like this. And if you look up the addresses of the owners, you'll find them living in supermarkets and you'll find them in older building complexes in Mumbai, where if you go to Google Maps and see, there's not a shipping company there. You know, I think it's very interesting that you have this huge fleet of oil tankers just working in Denmark every day, but nobody knows who's controlling them. And I think we need to get to the bottom of who is controlling them.
Now the Danish government pledges an international coalition will try to force better practices on the fleet. But how? Sanctions experts like Benjamin Hilgenstock at the Kyiv School of Economics Institute believe the key is to more aggressively target ships known to be flouting their obligation to have credible oil spill insurance.
So the vessel would be identified as a property of a sanctioned entity, but most importantly, anyone interacting with this vessel or the cargo that it carries could face enforcement action themselves. And this means the buyers of the oil that it transports, any port that interacts with the vessel, if there is a ship-to-ship transfer, anyone who owns or operates the vessel that the cargo is transferred to, importantly, financial institutions that conduct the transactions behind this entire trade, all of them ultimately face enforcement action.
That recommendation goes further than the European Union's latest sanctions on some shadow fleet vessels, banning them from European ports and services. But the measures can't physically block the ships from sailing through the international waters like the Danish Straits. Whether and how to do that is highly controversial. Here's Peter Viggo Jakobsen, an analyst with the Royal Danish Defence College.
The problem is that there's not that many good options, because you can either make an environmental case saying that these ships who are now passing through the Danish Straits are in so poor condition that they are creating an environmental hazard, and therefore we can stop them. You can also go after them and say they don't have insurance, and therefore they should not be allowed to go through the Danish Straits. I just don't see that as a solution, because, okay, so you can say this ship does not have insurance. Now it's approaching the Danish Straits. What are we going to do? And are we willing to go out and intercept and stop this ship? Because if we are, then we are in the crosshairs of Moscow saying, okay, Denmark just stopped the ship. So we'll just make the next ship going through, make sure that it has an accident so that they have a huge pollution in Danish waters, and then Denmark can do the cleanup. And good luck with that.
Moscow has already threatened Denmark with retaliation just for considering a response to the Dark Fleet. But without one, billions of dollars in what could be illegal oil revenue will continue flowing through European waterways to the Kremlin war chest. Terry Schultz, DW, Copenhagen.
To keep up to date with news from around Europe, head to our website, dw.com. And if you have any feedback on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com. We're always pleased to hear from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Germany. Most people probably wouldn't say no to a shorter working week. More time to relax, less stress. And many studies show that it increases productivity and job satisfaction. But could a shorter working week also have a beneficial impact on the environment? That's the question we'll be exploring in the next half hour. Our colleagues at DW's podcast, Living Planet, have been finding out more.
This is Living Planet. I'm Kathleen Schuster. In this episode, we're going to hear from Living Planet's Jennifer Collins, who's been exploring the debate around the four-day work week. Working less for the same pay sounds great, but could it also help the climate? Hey, Jen.
Hey, Kathleen.
I hear you've been on vacation for a few weeks.
Yeah, I have been. I was actually just in my hometown, Dublin, for a bit of a visit. And while I was there, I also did some work, even though I was on vacation. So I took a little trip to probably what is a bit of an unlikely place to find out a bit more about this. And that was the local hairdressers for a blow dry. I think you call it a blowout in the US.
Yeah, we do call it a blowout. But I feel like a blowout in Ireland, I feel like I need to put that on my bucket list. That sounds way more fun for some reason.
I was very happy with the result. Had a lovely kind of curly blow dry, you know. So the salon itself is called Head Office. And it's in a really working class area of Dublin called Ballyfermot. And it opens from Monday to Saturday, 9 to 5. And it looks like your typical salon. You know, wash basins, a little reception desk at the entrance, a few workstations in front of mirrors, and then there's like a nail artist in the corner.
Is that where you got your nails done? Because they look fabulous.
I didn't. I got those in Berlin, but thank you. Yeah, but it's a hive of activity and there are just loads of regulars in there getting their hair washed, cut, coloured, styled, you know, sitting with cups of tea and coffee and just chatting, and the radio is kind of pumping out music in the background.
Hiya.
And it's a real community hub too.
But they come at the same time and you get to know the grandchildren will come in and get their hair done, their children will get their hair done. But a lot of people just come in because they're lonely. A lot of people would come in just for a blow dry, for a chat, and they'd stay here for coffee. And we'd often get people staying here for 2 or 3 hours and they'd be finished in 20 minutes.
That's the salon owner, Amanda Dennison, and she's been running the place for about 30 years. So Amanda is also doing something that's kind of a bit unusual in her busy salon, and that's implementing a four-day work week for herself and her five staff.
All the girls only work most 4 days and then 3 days. 2 days.
Why did she decide to do that? Because I can imagine that it's not that easy when you're running a busy business that's open 6 days a week.
So one big reason was that most of the women working there have kids.
As long as they let me know, they can change days and we can walk around them, because life gets in the way. Sometimes they have appointments or their parents getting older now, they need to be brought places. Children are sick.
I can totally relate to that. I mean, I know a lot of parents. I'm a parent myself, and yeah, trying to work like a 9-to-5 schedule can be really tough.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, having an understanding work environment for that must be like a really important thing to have. But the interesting thing is that Amanda and her salon are also kind of accidentally part of this burgeoning movement to move to a 4-day work week. And there are some pretty big pilot schemes around the world that have shown that cutting down to 32 hours a week for the same pay as 40 hours has benefits for businesses, employees and...
Reducing working time would reduce our carbon emissions.
So that's according to a number of studies and researchers like Jack Kellum, who you just heard there. He's head of operations at Autonomy, which is a UK-based think tank that focuses on the future of work and the climate crisis. They also work with companies to implement four-day work weeks.
So working 32 hours a week could be better for the environment than 40?
Yeah, and that's something we'll really get into later in the episode. But first, Kathleen, have you ever wondered where the 40-hour work week comes from?
Yeah, it seems like the 40-hour, 5-day week has been around forever, at least in the Western world. But obviously that can't be the case.
It's actually a relatively recent phenomenon.
A weekend probably seemed like a challenge to companies to implement 100 years ago. And was similarly faced many of the similar criticisms that the 4-day working week does nowadays. You know, couldn't possibly work in this sector. You know, the economy would collapse. That was heard about the weekend at the beginning of the 20th century.
So let's do what we love on Living Planet and take a little historical journey into the evolution of work. Let's go back to, say, 13,000 years ago, before the advent of agriculture, to the time of the hunter-gatherer. You've picked up yourself a nice little haul of fish and some freshwater mussels. That'll pair nicely with the wild plants and nuts you picked the other day. Now you've just got to prepare your food and build a fire. You've probably put in about 20 hours of graft this week, which is the average work time for a hunter-gatherer, according to researchers. Now, after you've had your meal, you can kick back, shoot the breeze with your group, or perhaps do a hunter-gatherer hobby. Fast forward a few thousand years and humans have switched from foraging to farming. We're living in larger settled communities, populations are growing and technology and wealth are advancing. You're probably working about 30 hours a week on the farm, tending to cattle and crops. But your work is determined by seasons and when the sun rises and sets. You're not required to clock in or clock out at set times. In the 19th century, as urban centres, wealth and populations grow, people are getting together, swapping ideas and inventing new machines that make economies more productive. Advancements in technology mean fossil fuels like oil and coal are more accessible and factories run on them begin to spring up. Hourly wage labour becomes the norm, but conditions in factories are often terrible. You toil 16 hours a day, 6 days a week in dangerous conditions with no ventilation. Sunday, the traditional Christian day of rest, is your only day off. You're not exactly happy with your lot. You join a trade union, which is campaigning for better conditions and wages, as well as Saturdays and Sundays off. One of the slogans, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what you will, really catches on. Titans of industry aren't on board. They worry about the effect on their businesses and the economy. Some argue that 2 days off could make workers lazy and lead to moral decay. Idle days breed mischief, says one real estate mogul. The workers' movement starts to see some successes. In 1926, car manufacturer Henry Ford becomes one of the first employers to implement a 5-day, 40-hour work week. It's good for productivity, and other companies follow suit. Eventually, laws are implemented codifying things like paid overtime. Okay, so it's a bit more complicated than that, Kathleen, but that's a very condensed version of how the 5-day work week and the weekend were invented. And it's really stuck. Even though, as Jack Kellum from Autonomy explains, famous economists like John Maynard Keynes predicted back in the 1930s that because of higher productivity and automation,
we'd all be working 15-hour weeks by this point. We've seen these massive changes in the last 100 years, which have made society considerably more productive, and yet we're still working a very long working week and still have basically the same 2 days off that workers had 100 years ago. That doesn't square with the productivity improvements we've had. Where is it gone? Because it hasn't gone to workers, right?
Interesting. So why has the debate about shortening the work week gained such prominence again now?
So some economists and activists have been arguing for a shorter work week for quite a while, but it's really started to go mainstream.
Particularly since the pandemic, there's been an increase in companies particularly having a sort of difficulty around recruitment and retention for staff. So I think that's come up more and more as a reason that companies are interested in offering a 4-day working week. And
Kellum is referring to the ongoing labour shortage worldwide that's partly connected to strong economic growth. So there's just more jobs to fill, as well as ageing populations, which means there just aren't enough people to replace retiring workers. The US, for example, saw an unprecedented labour market reshuffle during the pandemic, and that became known as the Great Resignation. So basically, workers quit en masse for reasons like poor wages, inflexible remote work policies, and job dissatisfaction. And the lack of workers has really hit almost every sector. So restaurants have been struggling to find servers and cooks, hospitals are short on doctors and nurses, and construction companies need more builders. So essentially, it's a workers' market, and if staff aren't happy, they're just going to move on and look for better conditions, like shorter working hours.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So actually, a shorter working week is one of the reasons that Dublin salon owner Amanda Dennison says her staff have been with her for so long. Four of them have been there for over 20 years.
I'm very blessed in that way, because the girls are with me a long time, and it works out better for the business and for the customers. The girls are happy in here, and everyone says that walks through the door.
Autonomy has been working with London non-profit 4-Day Week Global, the University of Cambridge and Boston College on a number of ongoing pilot schemes in countries like the US, UK, Ireland, New Zealand and South Africa, which have been...
For the last 2.5 years, studying companies who are giving their employees 4-day reduced work weeks with no reduction in pay.
That's Juliette Shore. She's an economist, sociologist and professor at Boston College, and she's a lead researcher at 4-Day Week Global. Before we get into the climate impact, I'll just explain a bit about how the pilots work and the outcomes for businesses and employees.
Yeah, sounds good. Go for it.
So as part of the pilot project, staff retain 100% of their pay for working 80% of the time, but they have to keep up their previous level of productivity. The trials are mostly made up of white-collar firms, but they also include some construction, manufacturing and healthcare businesses too. And the UK trial has also got a fish and chip restaurant and a brewery. And in nearly all of the trials so far, most companies say they intend to stick with the reduced work week. Take the UK trial. Some 61 organisations signed up to a 6-month pilot in 2022. Results announced in February this year found 89% of companies said the policy was still in place. More than half of them said they were making the switch permanent. Resignations have plummeted, which means firms don't have to waste time training new people. They also said they have bigger and better application pools, and...
Many of them say productivity went up at the very least. They're not losing productivity.
The trials used 27 indicators to measure employee well-being, including their experience at work, life outside of the job, and they found...
Just really remarkable increases in well-being on pretty much all of the measures. Burnout, stress, fatigue, more positive emotions, fewer negative, big decline in work-family and work-life conflicts, more exercise, less anxiety, better sleep...
In the UK trial, 96% said it had benefited their personal life and 87% said it had a positive impact on their work. And most said they just wouldn't like to go back full time.
If these trials are anything to go by, it seems like it's very good for employees. Surprise, surprise. But they also seem to be working for many of the employers. What about the environment, though? This is an environment podcast, after all.
Sorry, Kathleen, I know I'm taking a while to come to the environment part. So there are a few ways to look at the climate impact here, right? In the trials, Shore and her colleagues wanted to get data on
how carbon footprints for households and also the companies would be changing, because you have the building energy use, right? If a company is shutting down one day, you want to count that, but more people are in their houses, so they are using more electricity, heat or air conditioning, for example.
But Shore says the data on household and company energy wasn't really usable. They also wanted to see if any benefit from working less might be outweighed by what people did in their spare time. Like, would they jet off somewhere for the long weekend? But...
It's really hard with carbon use because carbon is an input into pretty much everything that people do. Everything you buy, every activity that you have has some energy component to it. I mean, some of it may be very small. You may be just walking somewhere, but remember, you're using calories, which mean you have to eat more, you know, so it's a devilish problem.
They asked people at the beginning and the end of the trial about their personal carbon footprint and the kinds of activities they were doing with their extra time. The idea being that more time enables people to make healthier and more sustainable choices. Instead of eating a frozen pizza or convenience food, which has a higher environmental impact, you have time to cook fresh food. Or instead of jumping in a car, you might cycle or take public transport instead to get where you're going. And what the researchers found was that people did make more sustainable choices and they weren't flying all over the place on multiple vacations.
And when we ask people what they're doing on the off day, for the most part, they're staying close to home, they're doing low carbon things, personal grooming, housework and hobbies.
Interesting. So there's a correlation between just having the time to think about the environment and or just think about taking better care of yourself.
Yeah, exactly. You just have a little bit more mental space to do that. And that actually chimes with what hairdresser Amanda Dennison said when I asked her what she does on her day off.
For me, I'd go hiking.
According to the researchers, personal carbon footprint,
it does fall a little bit.
Okay, interesting. So not a huge drop.
Yeah, and the other area where they expected a big carbon saving was traveling to and from work.
I mean, there are some reductions in carbon use. Commuting by car goes down by about 1%, so very small. Commute time falls by about 1/2 hour a week, so that's significant.
So again, not huge.
No, though Shore says that's partly because they started the trials during the pandemic, when remote working became more common and...
The movement back into the workplace has been slow for a lot of people.
Okay, interesting. So the environmental benefits seem kind of modest.
Yeah, so Shore and her researchers say there are benefits compared to working a 40-hour work week, but it's something they are trying to collect more data on for sure. And we'll come back to another aspect of the climate impact a bit later.
I do have another question, though. I can see how this would fly in certain kinds of work environments, but what about a hospital?
Yeah, the four-day work researchers say it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, and organisations really have to figure out what works for them. Like, in an office, you might try to streamline your workflows, and when many companies did that, they dropped things like meetings, for example. But manufacturing companies, let's say, they might not have a lot of meetings to cut out. That doesn't mean that they can't make it work, though. Take the UK brewery I mentioned earlier. So brewing has these really intense periods of work, and they...
did time and motion studies on every one of their machines. Brewing involves lots of different processes, a lot of cleaning of equipment, and they figured out sort of how to order tasks differently and how to fit some tasks into the dead time in others, and ended up saving a lot of time that way.
Dublin salon owner Amanda Dennison says she no longer takes walk-ins and has switched exclusively to bookings, which makes schedules easier to manage. She does say you need to make sure you're taking in the same amount of money each month.
It'd be a certain amount of money they'd have to take in per day. And once they do that, and it covers for the week, yeah, you could do it.
But some places, like you mentioned hospitals, Kathleen, they might actually have to hire extra staff. And that's kind of difficult given the lack of staff globally. This actually brings us to some criticism of the four-day workweek compared to a five-day one.
The point is the findings can only be applied to the companies that took part in the experiment.
That's Holger Schäfer, who's a labour market economist at the German Economic Institute, a think tank in Cologne. Basically, Schäfer thinks the results don't really tell us much about introducing reduced errors across the economy for two reasons. One is that the companies who took part in the trial wanted to, so there's kind of a positivity bias there. And second, there's no control group.
Why is that important? Let's say I look at how sales performance develops and see revenue has gone up or stayed the same, but I can't say anything about the impact of the four-day work week if we don't compare these findings to those of another company that didn't shorten its hours.
Schäfer also says productivity wasn't measured consistently in the trial.
Productivity is value added per hour worked. And what was measured there was at best sales development. But that's not the same as productivity. Productivity is turnover minus input.
And that many particularly large companies have already trimmed the fat off their workflows as much as possible.
Ich wüsste nicht, wo diese Produktivitätsreserve herkommen soll.
I'm not sure where this productivity reserve is supposed to come from. We have companies in the manufacturing industry, for example, that have squeezed out every ounce of productivity for decades.
Actually, Schäfer says that a drop-off in productivity growth will be a disaster for the economy.
We're talking about a decline in the order of 20%, and not just for a year, but permanently. That is catastrophic, to put it mildly. The consequences are unimaginable.
We'll get to some of those potential consequences in a bit. But the idea of productivity growth gets to the core of some fundamental questions about the nature of work, how we value our time, and whether economies can keep growing infinitely on a finite planet. Ultimately, four-day workweek advocates say the big climate gains and emission cuts don't come from your personal carbon footprint, but...
when you slow down your growth rate, or if you contract. We see that in a recession, emissions fall because there's still a pretty strong connection between how much you produce and how much you emit. That's where you get the bigger savings, less than in the sort of household adjustment.
So something like that kind of happened during the pandemic. There was a big dip in CO2 emissions when part of the global economy shut down, but those emissions rebounded quickly when everything started to open up again. Several studies show a link between long working hours and high carbon emissions, particularly in richer countries. One paper Juliette Shore co-authored in 2012 looked at OECD countries between 1970 and 2007 and found that a 10% drop in working hours corresponded to a carbon reduction of around 14.6%. Another study by British environmental group Platform predicted that the UK could decrease its emissions by around 127 million tonnes by 2025 if it went down to a four-day week.
But what exactly is happening here?
It all comes down to productivity, and it gets a bit technical here, but imagine you're selling lemonade and you figure out a way to squeeze more lemons faster, or you make more lemonade with the same number of lemons. That means you're being more productive. You can take that productivity gain by selling more and raking in that sweet lemonade money, or you can work less.
It is very hard to take away income from people once they have it. Instead of income increases, let's give people increases in time. It's a trade-off of future income for time.
But if we do that, the economy stops growing or at least slows down. And I hear that's a bad thing.
Exactly. Without sustained increases in productivity, there is no economic growth, says the World Bank. And this gets to the question that some economists and climate researchers are at odds over. Basically, whether we can continue to grow our economies, just in a greener way, or if we have to forsake growth, at least in rich countries with high living standards that are responsible for most historical emissions heating the planet. According to economist Holger Schäfer, that would seriously hurt well-being.
And we must be aware that this has serious consequences, not only for our level of prosperity, but also what we can redistribute, for example, for social purposes. There are also goods and services that have to be produced. Tax revenue is roughly proportional to what we produce. That is the state's tax base. And if less is produced, less is taxable. That is unavoidable.
And really it comes down to how much we need to transform our economies in the face of the climate crisis. The answer to that, for some, is perhaps something like green growth. That means continuing to grow but moving away from greenhouse gas emitting fossil fuels, creating circular economies to reuse resources and essentially decoupling growth from emissions.
We've actually succeeded in the past in decoupling wealth and consumption, and hope this will be the case in the future with technical progress. I can't say whether that will be enough. I'm not a climate expert. But I think that's a more promising approach, because no one's left behind.
And Schäfer is right. Some rich industrialised countries like Germany have decoupled growth from planet heating emissions. A 2021 analysis found that 32 countries have managed to grow their economy without increasing their emissions. After accounting for emissions embodied in goods they imported from abroad, this fell to about 23 countries. But in big economies from Brazil to Indonesia, growth and pollution are still tightly linked. And a 2020 paper found decoupling rates were too slow to hold global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Current policies put us on track for a disastrous 2.9 degrees Celsius warming by the end of the century. Researchers say the consequences of planetary heating could also shave trillions off global GDP by 2050. So either way, countries have to be ready for a decline. And one policy that could
reconcile, in a way, ecological and social sustainability is working time reductions.
That's Philip Frey from the Karlsruhe Institute for Technology Assessment and Systems Analysis in Germany. So Frey actually did an assessment of how much work would be ecologically sustainable going forward.
The economic system that we have today is set up in such a way that continuous economic growth is very important to stabilize the labor market and thus also our social systems. So I think in that sense, these economists are right. We need economic growth in the current system.
But that got him thinking.
But just increasing our productivity, increasing our industrial output more and more might not be ecologically sustainable.
When Frey did his assessment, he found
a 9-hour work week would still be sustainable given our level of productivity and our level of carbon intensity.
That surely would be unmanageable.
Yeah, and Fry says himself that a switch to a 9-hour work week
would be something like degrowth by disaster or something. Yeah, it would also be unimaginable. I mean, I cannot see a social consensus around a 9-hour work week that would be linked to very, very deep cuts into consumption and various areas of our lives.
But he says the question for him is,
if we move towards a more sustainable economy, what can that look like?
What could it look like?
So there aren't really easy answers here, but Fry comes back to reduce working hours and uses the example of collective bargaining for German steelworkers. So green steel production is going to require fewer working hours. So unions pushed for a 4-day working week while maintaining levels of pay. So basically like sharing out the work rather than having layoffs.
And they basically argued, okay, we want a transformation towards a more sustainable economy, but in that economy, there will be less need for industrial manufacturing labor, basically. And what our proposal is basically to reduce the working hours per worker so we all can maintain our lifestyle and still provide green steel to the economy.
We'll need technological fixes like transitioning to green steel to stop the unfolding climate disaster. But that technology doesn't operate in a vacuum. Automation technologies and cleaner tech can liberate us from work and give us more time, or they can eat up any efficiency gains, like we've seen with bigger and bigger cars. And that can push us towards more growth.
Sounds pretty complicated, and like it would be a huge undertaking to get everyone on board.
Yeah, totally. But we also know we can't keep consuming and emitting as we are without walking further into environmental disaster. At the same time, it's really hard to imagine a world without growth and how we could get there. And the question of the shorter working week does give us a way to critically approach the world of work and how our economies operate. And it also gives us the space to ask what is ultimately important to us. Like, instead of focusing on what we could lose by limiting our consumption, we could look at what we could gain instead.
There's actually an attractive offer there that basically people could be freer to enjoy their own time. And what really moved me in the beginning of my research was a study conducted with people in retirement homes that were about to die and what regrets they have. And many of them basically said, looking back, I would have liked to spend more time with my family and friends and less time working.
Back in the head office salon in Dublin, owner Amanda Dennison says time is something she has really come to value as she's gotten older. During the Irish economic boom years of the 2000s, she hadn't even considered that she could work less.
We're afraid to lose our jobs. The amount of time that we had to let down our families because we were told by our jobs. And since COVID especially, you realise you can be closed down overnight and nobody has any control about anything.
And that extra time has also given her something else.
So I go up into the mountains and back to nature. And I think that gives you appreciation for the environment. That does make you realise like you're such a small pebble. When you stand on top of the mountain and looking out at the sea, you're just a small pebble in this world and you're not really that important. You haven't got that right to destroy it. So I think that's... But I think, again, because I have that time, that mental space, I can take that in. Where if you're stressed and you have to work 5 or 6 days a week, you're not going to be able to take that in.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for those insights. That was really surprising and gave me a lot to think about.
Thanks, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
Reporter Jennifer Collins, ending that edition of DW's Living Planet, hosted by Kathleen Schuster. And that's it from us here at Inside Europe. This week, sound engineer Jan Winkelmann was riding the faders and pushing all the right buttons. And I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.